From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Congressional leaders are scrambling today. They're trying to revise the $700 billion bailout bill the House of Representatives rejected yesterday. The stock market is struggling to make a rebound, too. Yesterday was the largest one-day point drop ever. And here to break down the news is the New York Times' international business editor, Marcus Mabry. Marcus, we have been hearing a lot from you. Great to have you on.
Thanks for having me, Farah.
So what do you think caused this bill to go down in defeat?
Well, you know, the very simple answer to that is politics. I think there are many people who understand, both in Congress and throughout the nation, that this is not just a Wall Street bailout bill. This is increasingly what's been called now, you hear the term a lot more in the media, a rescue plan, because it's not just Wall Street, but it's Main Street too. But I think what happened in the end, despite that understanding, is the fact that we are only 5 weeks away from an election. There are many members of Congress in both parties who will be standing for re-election. There is great dislike of this bill out there amongst American voters. And I think you're just trying to accomplish a huge amount, a $700 billion price tag on this bill in a very short period of time in a hyper-politicized environment. And I think in the end, politics won out over economic logic.
When we're going to have on back-to-back two representatives who voted differently on this bill, but you had differences within the Democrats and then differences among the parties. What do you think is really important here? I mean, who do you have to get to the table in order to pass any kind of bill?
Well, you know, it's really interesting. This is really kind of politics 101. You know, those of us who are of the Gen X generation remember, of course, you know, a little Schoolhouse Rock ditty called I'm Just a Bill.
And I'm only a bill and I'm sitting here on Capitol Hill.
Exactly. and if we go back to that, you know, this is again, politics 101, this is lawmaking 101. You don't have to get everybody there, but you have to get a number to get across the finish line. Now, they were 12 votes short. The Republicans say that Nancy Pelosi failed with her, you know, partisan speech. The fact is it's really hard to buy that. The Republicans admit themselves after that, they've admitted after the recriminations against Pelosi, they've come out and said that they could not deliver the votes they said they could. They thought they could get 50% of their caucus, and they couldn't do that in the end. You have to either get some of those one-third of Democrats or who voted against it, or 40% of Democrats voted against it, or some of those two-thirds of Republicans that voted against it. You have to get some of them at the table, not everyone. So you either have to get, you know, most members, the vast majority of the Congressional Black Caucus, for instance, liberal Democrats. They voted against it based on the fact that this was going to let fat cats on Wall Street off the hook. Well, maybe if you do some deals where you put in some more financial inducements and help for local and state governments, which are going to face an incredibly hard time now as this recession no doubt deepens that we are on the verge of. So you could either do that to bring those Democrats on, kind of popular bailout of local and state governments, or you could turn around on the other side and offer some more mortgage insurance, for instance, so the American taxpayers might have to pay less of the bill in the final tabulation. That might bring some Republicans on. So there are inducements you can do on either side, either to attract conservative Republicans or to attract liberal Democrats. I think you have to do one or the other. You probably can't do both, and you most certainly will not be able to change the fundamentals of this bill to make it look so attractive that those who are in close congressional races, whether they are Democrats or Republicans, those people in close races are not likely to support this bill ever. It's just not in their political interest. And so I don't think that's going to happen. You're going to have to either win either side of the extremes, quote unquote, to I think, limp across the finish line and get a majority. And the first opportunity we have to make that happen is Thursday. It's going to be interesting to see how do global markets react as we wait and see for the American Congress to actually make something happen. I think there's little alternative but to make something happen.
All right. Well, just give us a quick taste of what you think of the psychology of the stock market. We saw this plunge in numbers yesterday, somewhat of a rebound today. Is the psychology of whether or not the stock market does well at this point almost completely linked to whether or not this some kind of package passes?
To some extent, yes. The fall yesterday, absolutely. That was about psychology. The market expected it to pass. The market doesn't mind bad news, but it doesn't like bad news when it doesn't expect it. And so right now, the market's going to be in a wait-and-see attitude. I think, once again, kind of miraculously so far, you know, the market has not gone off a cliff again. There's been somewhat of a rebound as people realize that every stock took a hit yesterday. Not every stock in every company is bad, however. So people are now coming back in and buying those stocks that were unfairly sold off yesterday. So, but I think the overall economy of the market is going to, I hope, maintain this wait and see attitude for a few days. But again, if by the end of the week we don't see any progress or even see a deal out of this, I think the market is going to be very unforgiving. And I think that's where the warnings that the administration has made, that congressional leadership in both parties have made about dire economic consequences, the lack of credit, you know, frozen credit markets, mm-hmm. and credit is what makes companies run. It allows companies to pay payroll. That's where the dire consequences will start to affect regular Americans. And I think maybe you'll see a difference.
Okay, Marcus, thank you.
Thank you.
That was Marcus Mabry. He's the international business editor for The New York Times, and he joined us from the NPR studios in New York. So why did some members of Congress choose to vote for the bailout bill and some against it? We've got two prominent members of Congress who made up their own minds and made different choices. A little bit later, we're going to talk to Representative Sheila Jackson Lee of Texas, who voted against. But first, we have Representative Maxine Waters of California, who voted for. How are you?
Hello. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. So you voted for this bailout bill. Why?
This is a rescue effort that caught everybody by surprise. The fact of the matter is, not only do we have to be concerned about our financial institutions and the markets, we've got to be concerned about trying to do something to stem the tide of foreclosures and keep people in their homes. And part of this bill had in it a modification plan. We're going to acquire, that is, buy up all of this toxic paper, a bad paper, from these financial institutions. We then have an opportunity to do the kind of modifications that we've been urging all along. In addition to that, we have small businesses that are at risk. These small businesses that depend on banks for loans to make the payroll will literally go out of business. And we have the small and minority banks. Many of them who had their money invested in Fannie and Freddie when it was taken over, and they've lost all of their investment in that preferred stock. So we're trying to stem the tide of this devastation to get the market stabilized and to protect the average citizen. So I know that when you talk about $700 billion for Wall Street, it really unnerves people. They don't want to see the big boys be bailed out by the government. Many don't understand the connection to the average person and to their communities yet, but eventually they will. The market responded in a very negative way yesterday, over 700 points down, and I don't know where it's going to go, but if it continues, we will have a disaster on our hands for real.
Do you get calls? You're someone who's obviously well-known locally and nationally. Mm-hmm. Do you get calls at your office from people saying, absolutely don't do this or absolutely do
yes.
this? What are
yes.
your constituents saying to you?
It's a mixed bag. Most of the calls are vote no from all different parts of the district. And we're taking those calls, recording those calls, and we're asking people to listen to, you know, the debate and the information in the news. And I call them back. And I talk to them separately. And many people say, oh, I didn't understand. Or some people who feel that they don't have to be worried about a 401k plan. They don't have a retirement plan. They don't have any money in stock. They're not in danger of foreclosure. They still won't support the idea that we should spend any money on this effort. But most people who have money in a 401k plan or a pension plan do begin to understand rather quickly.
Like many politicians, real estate industry is a part of your donation space. Does that influence how you vote?
No, I serve on the Financial Services Committee, and I am the chair of the subcommittee on housing and community opportunity. I get very little in the way of campaign contributions. I don't take money from the big banks. I do take money from, like, credit unions and from some of the real estate industry, but not money from the financial sector at all. I don't accept those contributions.
What do you think lies ahead for your colleagues and you? I mean, Thursday is being touted as another date that is going to be incredibly important in terms of decision making. But do you think that Congress is going to be able to pull it together?
Oh, yes. There will be a bill. And it will probably be pretty much the same as this bill. There may be a few minor changes or alterations to it. But there will be a bill that will be passed. And I think even some of the no votes are surprised at the response on Wall Street and the market and what took place. And I think we're going to continue to get information about the international impact of our meltdown here. And I do think that we'll have the votes on Thursday or Friday, whenever we vote. We may not necessarily vote on Thursday. We may just start the discussion. But I think by the weekend, we'll have a vote and we'll have a bill that will pass.
Give me just a quick hit on what you think the best case scenario is for your district, how a good bill could change things for people in your district.
Well, I had in the bill a language for participation by minorities in all business aspects of this rescue. For example, there will be a lot of asset management, which will include investment banking firms and accountants and lawyers and consultants. And I had a minority piece in there to make sure that there was diversity in the opportunities. I also had language in there to protect small and minority banks. And I also worked on the language for the loan modifications. So the bill as it is will help my district an awful lot.
All right, Congresswoman, thank you.
You're welcome.
That was U.S. Congresswoman Maxine Waters, who represents California's 35th district. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. South Africa swears in a new president. Nigerians bid to buy a British soccer team. And former President Bill Clinton convenes celebrities and changemakers in New York around the issues of global poverty. That's all in our Africa update. And for more, we've got Bill Fletcher. He's a senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies and former president of Trans-Africa Forum. How you doing, Bill?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing great. So it sounds very schmancy. You've got, you know, celebrities and people from NGOs coming to something called the Clinton Global Initiative. It had its annual meeting in New York last week. I know because I was there and I got stuck in some of the traffic that included those people. So how important is this? I mean, there are different convenings of people around issues like global poverty, but how important is this one?
Well, I'll give you two answers on that, Farai. On the one hand, yes, this is an important gathering, and former President Clinton has assembled with his initiative quite a list of important people. There's major money that's involved in this, so it's not just show and glitter. There is something here. My other answer, though, is something that I've been thinking about for quite some time, but this conference really raised it to the level of, here's the problem. Clinton and others treat the problems of Africa as problems, and this is also an issue with Bono. They treat it as something that needs to be handled through essentially donors, foundations, private donors. They treat it as if it's a charity case, as opposed to that the problems that face Africa are problems that are very much linked up with what governments have done in the past and should be doing in the future. So I get very uneasy about these private ventures.
So what is the other option? I mean, you know, celebrity activism has become one of the hallmarks of the late 20th, early 21st century. And you mentioned Bono. He's definitely an example of that. Angelina and Brad. Is there a good role for people who have that kind of power, that kind of public position?
Yes, yes, absolutely. I'm please don't misunderstand me. I'm not trying to trash Bono or Angelina Jolie or other people. It's more that there's a problem in the way we think about this, that charity, foundations, giving ends up substituting for government policy. That's more what I'm trying to get at. And that it seems to me that what we need from someone like former President Clinton is someone who is an advocate for the policies that the U.S. government and other governments in the global north, Europe and Japan particularly, should be doing. And that we need that sort of pressure. When you have individual giving, it lets governments off the hook. It makes it appear once again that the problems that face Africa and other parts of the global south are natural problems, problems that have nothing to do with history, problems that are just examples of an unfortunate set of circumstances, as opposed to, Farai, that there's history linked here and that governments do have an obligation to step forward and help.
Well, let's move on to South Africa. Last week, just days after the South African president, Thabo Mbeki, announced his resignation, the deputy leader of South Africa's ruling African National Congress Party was formally sworn in as South Africa's new president.
I, Kgalema Petrus Motlanthe, swear that I will be faithful to the Republic of South Africa and observe, uphold, and maintain the Constitution and all other law of the Republic, and I solemnly and sincerely promise that I will always promote all that will advance the Republic and oppose all that may harm it.
What do we know about Motlanthe?
Certainly in South Africa, they know a lot more than we do here, because in the United States, we don't get a great deal of information about the real politics that's going on in South Africa. What we can say is that he is a caretaker. He is clearly not being positioned to formally succeed President Mbeki. That what we witnessed was a falling out within the ANC that was brought on largely by arrogance within the Mbeki camp, and the failure of Mbeki to secure the sorts of alliances that he needed in order to continue his administration. What we're not seeing, in some ways I'd say unfortunately, is a real struggle around policy, basic policy, economic policy, particularly with regard to South Africa.
Now, South Africa is preparing, among other things, to host the 2010 World Cup, seen as a huge, huge win for South Africa to host this enormous and vaunted soccer tournament. But some people are also saying that, you know, the last time I was in South Africa was roughly 18 months ago. And some people were saying, you know what, you haven't seen anything yet when it comes to crime. If our issues as poor people are not addressed, you will see a whole bunch of crime targeting tourists when they come in 2010. That's got to make the government afraid. How are things going to be prepared in terms of relating to actual South Africans in advance of a big world event like that?
Well, I guess a part of that depends on what economic policies are pursued by the new government. But I think that the other thing that I would guess is that South Africa is not going to permit the soccer tournament to be deep sixed. They're not going to. They're not going to permit it to be a failure. And whether that means a massive mobilization of police, taking extraordinary actions to secure the situation for the tourists and participants. But I think that more than that, the people of South Africa, I don't know whether you've had this experience, but when I've been there, the joy that exists within South Africa that this is going to happen in 2010, people don't want to see this fail. And I think that the regular people on the streets will themselves take action. They want this to be
there's
a success.
There's actually a related topic that I just want to do a quick little touch on, which is that a consortium of Nigerian businessmen has made a bid to buy Newcastle United, which is a British soccer team. And reportedly, these men have come up with about $620 million so far, are looking for an additional $200 million plus or minus. So do you think that this is you know, kind of the colonies going back and saying, hey, we're staking our claim on your land. And what does it really mean?
I think it's the Nigerian equivalent of the U.S. buying Beckham. You know, it's like, let's get our piece of the rock. Let's get let us demonstrate to the world that we're in this game. And it seems like the most ridiculous use of money that I could imagine at a time like this.
Well, on that note, Bill, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bill Fletcher is a senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies and the former president of TransAfrica Forum. He's also the author of Solidarity Divided, The Crisis in Organized Labor and a New Path Towards Social Justice. He was at NPR's Washington, D.C. headquarters. We're going to turn back to domestic politics and continue our discussion of the bill that failed in Congress yesterday. We heard earlier in the show from Representative Maxine Waters, who voted for the bill. Now we've got Representative Sheila Jackson Lee of Texas, who voted against the bill. Congresswoman, welcome.
It's a pleasure to be with your listeners today. How are you?
I'm doing great. So what made up your mind for you?
Well, I think there's no doubt that the individuals who were negotiating worked enormously hard to try and correct what was enormous disappointment in what was presented by the administration. The administration presented the Congress with two pages that literally named the Secretary of Treasury, I would say, God. And so there was an effort made to try to strengthen this bill. But my concerns were that the consumer did not have as much protection as I believe they were owed. And frankly, I believe we can make a better bill. Let me just cite some examples for you. $700 billion and not any allotment or designated amount that would address the question solely of the pending mortgage foreclosures, 2 million and growing. Limitations on judicial review. Certain authorities given to the Secretary of the Treasury would be barred from having judicial intervention. Then the sections dealing with a mortgage workout, the language said they would encourage the servicers to try and work out the complexities of an individual's mortgage. Well, that's a polite word, but it's not a forceful word. And then lastly on this point, if you were to get a mortgage restructuring through this legislation and your mortgage was held by multiple investors would have to sign off on the restructuring of your loan. So, for example, if the security was held by a Japanese investor, you'd have to get their approval. Much work was done, but I believe much work can be done, and I think we can have a better bill. And as a member of the House Judiciary Committee, I don't think there were sufficient enforcement powers that would in actuality penalize those who are engaged in criminal malfeasance. I want, for example, those individuals, narrowly drawn, of course, to be barred from doing business with the federal government. Well, the more protection we can have for the consumers, the better off we'll be.
Let me ask about your people, the people in your district. Give us a sense of who they are, what kinds of people you have in terms of their economic status. Have you been getting calls from them as this whole debate has played out? Give us a sense of the people you represent.
Well, I have been getting calls, and I think all of America has been engaged in this debate and this discussion. I sort of compare this to the intensity of the question of the Iraq War in 2002, one of the other situations where faith in our administration was ill-placed. I think that was part of the concerns of the American people and the people in my district who called. There was a lack of trust, and my district is very multicultural. It has Hispanics and African-Americans and Anglos and Asians. It is about 40% African-American and 35% and growing Hispanic and a portion Asian and, of course, a portion Anglo. All these numbers are growing, however, because our numbers are growing in Texas. They're hardworking people. There are some who are more economically able than others. I have some very, very poor people in the district, people who work very hard. So it's a really a cross-section. I have little towns in my district, historic areas in my district, and people who are really are hardworking but also have a sense of pride of being an American. Their concern was that it seemed that this bailout was on their backs when they had no fault whatsoever. And isn't it interesting to hear members of our Congress, members of the other party, suggesting that this mortgage crisis came about through the overutilization or the overemphasis on minorities getting mortgages, or that people were living above their means. This is what was said on the floor of the House. So my community had a certain distrust that all of the effort would be to help those who created this debacle and nothing for those who were actually victimized by it.
If you were to craft the bill completely on your own, you've given us some very distinct points that you would like. So I'm not saying that you should reiterate all of them. But maybe if you were to craft a bill that passed in 5 minutes from now, what would be the number one thing that you would ask for?
I would strengthen the enforcement so that there would not be any latitude to respond or not respond. I wouldn't have the word encourage. I would say must or shall rework the mortgages that are held by these investment banks. And I would put the onus or the burden on the investment bank to go ahead and restructure and, after the fact, secure the permission from their fellow investors. They should, in essence, guarantee or ensure the particular mortgagee, the holder of the mortgage, so that that person can go away whole with a restructured mortgage and not be victimized. The decision to bungle mortgages as security was not the decision of the individual homeowner. That homeowner went to some bank in some town with the good intentions of achieving the American dream. It was the mortgage investment houses who found this a golden goose, if you will, and decided to buy these up, and then decided to sell them off internationally, and then the international markets decided to buy them. So that would be the first instance. The second theme that I would have in it is to tell the markets to calm down, to let them look at history. The savings and loans catastrophe was certainly one that we felt we'd never recover from. It was bad. There were a lot of bad actors, but we recovered it in 7 years. I come from Texas, the Gulf region, where we saw the oil bust, thought we'd never come out of it. We came back stronger. Not to say that we wanted those unfortunate incidences or Enron, and we're coming back from that. The market needs to calm down. We need to ease the panic. We see some stability going on right now, and we truly need to write a bill that has some of the very important provisions that were already offered by my friend and colleague, Congressman Waters, who did a fantastic job on the idea of minority participation and community banks, of which I support strongly. And now add some enforcement provisions that would give greater authority to the Department of Justice, to other jurisdictional committees like the Judiciary Committee, House Oversight Committee, to ensure that our consumers, the innocent persons who live on Main Street or in our inner cities or rural communities, are truly protected.
Congresswoman, thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
That was U.S. Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee, who represents Texas's 18th District. And coming up next on News and Notes, R&B singer Faith Evans has lived through abuse and the murder of her estranged husband, the rapper Biggie Smalls. She documents it all in her new memoir, Keep the Faith. We'll be right back. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Albinos lack pigment in their skin. More than 24 albinos have reportedly been murdered in Tanzania since the beginning of the year. Vicky Entetema is the bureau chief for the BBC in Tanzania. While investigating this story, Entetema's own life was threatened, and she went into hiding. NPR's Tony Cox caught up with her after the reporter fled to Kenya.
Witch doctors want albino organs for magic potions, which they say make people rich. In March this year, President Jakaya Kikwete giving examples of the rituals performed by the so-called witch doctors in order to enrich their clients, said that some of them use herbs that send the victims into a coma before they draw blood by piercing a sharp object into the middle of the skull. And some of the killings are instigated by superstitious beliefs that one can be very successful businessman or woman in the mining and fishing activities if they use human organs in their rituals.
I understand that you recently went undercover, posing as a businesswoman to expose these witch doctors. Tell us what happened.
Now, two witch doctors promised to get me a magic potion mixed with ground albino organs. Their starting price was $2,000 for the vital organs, which are bones from the palms, hands, legs, and also blood and hair. And in one occasion, a witch doctor told me that the police were among his customers and that he could make a special magic potion mixed with ground male and female private parts to enable people to commit armed robbery without being caught.
Did you believe him that the police were aware of this and were a part of this?
Well, I believe because he told me that the man who was wearing civilian clothes outside the house where we were was a policeman, and he wanted some magic potions. And he was told to go in the morning and then come back in the afternoon. But my session took longer, and the witch doctor said that he didn't have any time for him and that he arranged for another day. That is when the man said to the witch doctor that why was he attending to me while I was an investigator of some sort? And that is the time when the threats now started coming through my phones.
What kinds of threats did you receive?
Well, a total of four phone calls from witch doctors with chilling messages such as, what have you done now? We thought you were our genuine client. Watch your back. Why are you doing this to us? So I recognized one number. The rest were from private numbers. I also received several anonymous calls. Nobody would say anything on the line, but I could hear someone breathing and sighing. So you see, I have stepped on people's toes there. I have denied some witch doctors their only means of generating income. And some families may feel that they are humiliated by my report because their parents, spouses, siblings, and relatives have been exposed and could be brought to book. But also, I have stepped on the toes of the policemen because the country says they were not able to find these witch doctors, and I did, and I'm just one person.
Did you have to go into hiding?
Yes, I'm out of the country right now, and I don't know how safe I am in Tanzania, but because of these threats, the BBC authority said that I should get out for a while and let things cool down. And, you know, experience shows that when journalists are successful in their investigative reports in Tanzania, they may face threats and sometimes are attacked. My colleagues from the Mwana Halisi papers have scars to show that although investigative journalism is what the media should embark on, if we are to bring about change in Tanzania, there are those few selfish people who would always oppose the progress in order to protect their interest. And I believe that there are some politicians, the police, businessmen who would go to witch doctors. And this information came from the highest officer of the police when I spoke to them.
Do you feel any regret because of the danger that this story has brought to you personally? Do you have any regrets about doing what you have done and uncovering and exposing what you have?
Not at all. I had to do it because from November 2007, until March, when I started investigating these albino killings, 19 people had been killed. And by the time I finished my report, 24 had been killed. Now the number is 26. So I don't regret, and I think I'm only one person. If they come and kill me, the report is out, the investigation is out, the witch doctors have been exposed, and if the police are involved, well, they'll face the courts. But at least I would save the albino community. At least I would say I died for a good cause, and maybe one less albino person would die. So I don't regret.
Earlier this year, the president of Tanzania ordered a crackdown of all those who were involved in ritualistic killings. Has anyone ever been arrested and prosecuted for killing an albino?
I understand that 173 witch doctors and the hired killers were arrested. But also, after our investigation, after the BBC investigative report, 34 more others have been arrested, and they are under police custody. But none of these has gone to court yet, and the police are saying that it's very difficult to gather evidence because people are very scared to come forward and say, I know this person has done X, Y, Z, or has killed so and so. Because in this region, the culture of secrecy rules the society. And when you say to the police that this witch doctor has killed so-and-so, it means that either the witch doctor or their families or their clans or the hired killers will come after you. So people are too scared to come forward and give that evidence in court.
Now, the president appointed the first albino member of parliament in April. Can you tell me more about her and what she's doing to stop the murders?
She wants the government to at least prosecute even one person in order to show that the government is really serious in their pledge of protecting these albinos. But also it is her job, she says, to go to the society and tell the people that, look, I'm here. We are ordinary people. We don't have magical powers. We struggle just like you. We need education, health services, just like ordinary Tanzanians. So give us a chance and we can make wonders, not by believing in superstitious rituals.
Vicky, this is a very compelling story. I want to thank you for your efforts and for coming on to News and Notes and sharing it with us.
Thank you for having me on your program, Tony.
That was Vicky Ntetema, Bureau Chief for the BBC in Tanzania. She was speaking with NPR's Tony Cox. That's the unmistakable voice of Faith Evans, known as the First Lady of Hip Hop. At 35 years old, she's been through more than most folks will in their entire lives. Faith was raised by her grandparents in a house full of children, foster children, and other relatives. By the age of 4, she found her first adoring audience in her church. By 15, she was climbing out of her bedroom window to go learn how to record and mix music. 3 years after that, Faith was a college dropout, a songwriter, a single mother, and the survivor of a brutal and abusive relationship. By 24, she was a successful singer and a widow. Now Faith Evans is telling all in her memoir, Keep the Faith, starting with the death of her estranged husband, the rapper Notorious B.I.G.
Basically, my life was changed in a matter of seconds. And I think that's pretty much how I did sum it up in the intro. I mean, before I even describe what I was doing and, you know, what he was doing. But, just in a matter of seconds, you know, my life as I knew it was changed. I mean, I had to very quickly put myself into gear to know that I had a lot of work to do. I mean, I had to kind of just be strong for a lot of people. And, you know, the funny thing is that I wasn't with any of them that night, but me being his only beneficiary that was an adult, you know, the next of kin. God, you know, it's just amazing how things, you know, how he aligns us and puts us in places at certain times. And there's always a reason. And, nobody ever expected that that would be the outcome of that particular evening. But there was a reason I was there. I mean, and, yeah, like I said, I just kind of had to put on a brave face and get ready to handle a lot of things.
When you realized that you were a widow and you're also a mother, also a songwriter and a singer, what did your vision of your life become in that period of grief? What did you see ahead for yourself? Did you see anything ahead for yourself?
Wow. I mean, to be honest, I couldn't even, I was in such a cloud. I mean, everything is a blur. I mean, my friends still remind me and walk me through certain times after then that, you know, you don't remember we were all here and doing that. And I'm like, I don't remember. I mean, I think I can't even tell you how long it was before, you know, I was able to even think about functioning as, you know, as an individual, as far as what I had to do for me. Recording, I wouldn't record. The only thing that I did was, you know, take my kids to school every day, you know. But other than that, I was completely in a big cloud.
Let's back up a little bit from this moment, which was not just a private moment, but it became a very public moment, like Tupac's death, where all these people were grieving. Mm-hmm. You know, here you were, a young widow and a young mother, but you were raised in a family that, like so many, was a network of people who you may not see as, you know, the traditional, you know, mom, dad, two kids, car, dog. Tell me how you grew up.
Well, my grandparents raised me. When they've been foster parents for as long as I can remember. And I was actually the first child other than their own that they actually took care of. They raised me since I was 6 months old, although my mom lived there as well. She was always, you know, raised me as well, but I lived in their house. I always kept myself around something musical, whether it was being in a play where I played the drunk daughter or sneaking out to the studio to make a, you know, demo that never became anything. But, you know, it was all a part of what I felt I needed to do beyond, you know, that house and beyond church. You know, I was always looking for something to do outside of that, of those four walls.
In this book, you talk about some really rough times you went through, being held out a window by an abusive boyfriend who threatened to drop you to your death, being beat up, being manipulated. Why do you feel that it was important to put all that in the book?
Well, it's a part of my life, you know? I mean, I couldn't possibly do a book about my life without sharing the important experiences, because although they weren't positive ones, you know, or fun things to go through, but they all serve a purpose in the person that I have become. That's something that I'm glad that I have, you know, learned to grasp. But I think that the things that I have experienced have enabled me to be able to be like, okay, you know, just kind of shrug things off and know that, okay, there's something better. I think that those things have made me who I am today, which I'm very much at peace with that person and proud of who I've become.
And you're a businesswoman. You talk very honestly in the book about having to sort the finances out, the tangled finances of the estate. And one specific thing that comes to mind for me is there was that incredible hit song, I'll Be Missing You, mm-hmm. That Sean Combs did. Were you guys benefiting from that? Was your family, was your son actually able to get some of the money that came out of that project?
Excuse me. Well, that was actually the only reason that I decided to do the record with Puff, because this was still at a time when I just kind of shut everything down. I had been working on my second album prior to Big's death. And I didn't go back in the studio until he called me and asked me to do this record. And the one line that, you know, that got me and hooked me was, all the money is going to go to the kids. All the royalties will go to CJ and Tiana. So, yes, they do have trusts set up where the royalties from that song go into that trust.
What is the thing that you're most proud of that you've done as a writer and a recording artist?
Most proud. Wow. I think I'm proud of the fact that I didn't even really, you know, when I actually got my record deal with Bad Boy, Puff heard me sing one line, and I wasn't there in any capacity of auditioning or anything. I was just the baby's mama in the lounge, and my opportunity came. I mean, and I didn't even think it was that. I mean, you know, I had been around several people, and that, like I said, most people would be singing at the top of their lungs, you know, trying to get discovered. But I kind of always played my position and, you know, like, well, when something is meant to happen for me, it will. And I went in the booth to sing one little line and, excuse me, Mr. Puffy, can I change it around? And I just did my little magic to it. And as soon as I walked out, he wanted to sign me to his new label. I mean, and I know that was nothing but the work of God. That was nothing but, because I still had to drive back home with the people that I drove there who were trying to get signed as producers, you know. As a writer, I think the fact that I was able to, and I wouldn't call it a fluke, but, you know, I didn't plan on being, you know, writing on these projects that I was on before I actually was showcased as an artist or singer. But it so happened to be that Puff was working on so many projects, from Total to Usher, Mary J. I mean, things that enabled my name to be a part of things that were monumental. And I, you know, I'm a person that reads credits. Even before I had anything to do with anybody's record company, I always read the names on albums and stuff for some reason. So it's just funny how my name, you know, that ended up sort of being part of what I did. You know what I mean? Now I definitely read them to make sure my name is where it should be.
That was singer Faith Evans. Her new memoir is called Keep the Faith. She joined me at our NPR West studios. You can watch video of this interview on our blog, nprnewsandviews.org.